All right, thank you, Jesse and Mariah and the worship team. I want to thank Jesse and all the work he put in this week to getting this place set up. It wasn't an easy task, so thank you all, too, for your flexibility of meeting in here today. Things went really well in the worship center this last week. We were able to get it painted and get some other folks in it, to do what they need to do, and carpet comes this week, and so next Sunday we'll be back in the worship center. So thank you for that. Things have gone well. If you know, especially if you know Dwayne and Marlis Vandy Vandell, I encourage you to just thank them. We've got a lot of volunteers that put a lot of time into it, but they certainly have gone above and beyond with their time in painting that worship center. So they did awesome. So I want to start with a question today, and that question is this: are you a cheater? You're a cheater. Now, when it comes to board games, I'll admit, I can be a bit of a cheater. My wife's family, side of the family, when we get together for holidays, Thanksgiving, Christmas, that type of thing, we play a board game. And if you win that board game, you don't get a trophy, but you get your name written on the inside of the box. They put the date and then the name of who won the game, and you live in infamy, right? Every time you gather, you've got bragging rights. Well, several Christmases ago, we were playing Balderdash. That's the game where you make up definitions to crazy words, and you have to guess the definition. You don't want people to guess yours and that type of thing. And I was close. Come down the last round, and I was kind of in the hunt, and my mother-in-law was the last reader, and I knew if I could guess the definition, I could pull off the win. Well, I was sitting right next to my mother-in-law and had a good view of the various cards. And I could see people's handwriting, and I could tell my mother-in-law's handwriting, and I did really well that round. So well that I won. So well that they wrote my name in the box. It's Christmas time, crying out loud. So the next morning I wake up and my conscience just will not let it go. I say, honey, I cheated last night. She's like, oh, how could you? But started moaning and grieving and all this. And then the shame the next day of having my name ceremonially removed, off the box. And there might have been even a probation period before I could play games again. It was just, it was rough. So, board games, I'm kind of tempted to cheat. But when it comes to something else, which is mini golf, I do not cheat. I played mini golf with some of you. Some of you are cheaters. Because you think mini golf is just a cuter version of hockey. And what I mean by that is, you hit your ball, and then before the ball stops moving, you guide it into the hole. What'd you get in that one? I got two. And I go, two? But you have to let the ball stop, and you have to hit it again. And then if it gets close to the side, you kind of kick it out a little bit. And you only get one putter length. That's all you get. Okay? That's all you get from the side. So if you're not playing mini golf, you start doing that, I'm calling you out. Just so you know. Alright, we play for real. Well, as funny as those examples might be, there are times when cheating isn't so funny. You read the news and you'll see investors who cheat their clients, you'll see politicians who cheat us, you'll see employers who cheat employees, and employees who cheat employers, and spouses who cheat on one another. Those types of cheating aren't funny at all. In fact, those types of cheating produce some of the most emotional and relational damage that we'll ever experience in life. And so as we jump back into Revelation this morning, we're looking at chapters 17 and 18. If you read ahead, or if you read these chapters, you already get the image of cheating. That's what John and the vision is about. In fact, if you noticed our sign for this week, you saw the title for the message today was called The Whore of Babylon. Yeah, all week we had that on our sign. 20,000 cars, 26th Street, every day. They saw that. Rhonda Graham said, if you know her, she's the one that changes the sign each Monday. And she got here Monday, and she comes over, and she says, for real? And I said, that's what the schedule says. And she says, well, I think I'm going to put that word on last. I'm like, I'm okay with that. However you want to do that. I think if you took a poll of all the churches in America, how many churches have ever had that word on their sign? We might be one of the few, not the only one. But when we get into it, you'll see why that imagery is pretty appropriate. A couple of things before we jump into the text. This is my first time teaching in this series, so you should know a few things before we jump in. When I come to the book of Revelation, when I come to any book, I approach the book twofold. The first is that I believe that John had a specific message for a specific group of people back in this time period when he was writing it. So I think for us to understand what the vision is about, we need to understand what John was trying to say to the people back then. And then, of course, since it's scripture, there's a message for us today as well. Also, I'm going to tell you there's too much stuff in here to go verse by verse, so we'll just kind of go theme by theme. I want to let you know that chapter 17 is probably the most difficult chapter in the book to figure out. And so even for people who know the book well, or for the scholars who have figured the book out pretty well, they stumble in chapter 17. So I personally want to thank Pastor Doug for taking today as vacation day and allowing me to stumble through this with you today. There is no Revelation group this Wednesday, which is great, so I can say whatever I want to say, and you won't get the opportunity to challenge me on Wednesday night. I'm teasing, kind of. The good news, though, is that chapter 18 has some really cool stuff in there, so we're just going to skip 17 and go to 18. I'm kind of teasing about that as well. But we're going to learn some stuff today, and hopefully we'll find some stuff that we can apply along the way as well. If you're using these Bibles, I hope you do. We don't have a screen this morning, so grab your pew Bible, turn to Revelation chapter 17. That is on page 958. All right. We're looking at the first six verses here. We're introduced to a new character, this prostitute of Babylon. John says this, "One of the seven angels who had poured out the seven bowls came over and spoke to me. 'Come with me,' he said, 'and I will show you the judgment that is going to come on the great prostitute who rules over many waters. The kings of the world have committed adultery with her, and the people who belong to this world have been drunk by the wine of her immorality.' So the angel took me in the spirit into the wilderness. There I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that had seven heads and 10 horns. And blasphemies against God were written all over it. The woman wore purple and scarlet clothing and a beautiful jewelry made of gold and precious gems and pearls. In her hand she held a gold goblet full of obscenities and the impurities of her immorality. A mysterious name was written on her forehead, 'Babylon the Great, mother of all prostitutes and obscenities in this world.' And I could see that she was drunk with the blood of God's holy people who were witnesses for Jesus. I stared at her in complete amazement." All right, a few things I want to note here. The first is that we're going to call this gal Lady Babylon from here on out. Okay, a lot of the commentators refer to her as that, and not Lady Gaga, Lady Babylon. Okay, I want to make that clear. But from here on out, we're just going to call her Lady Babylon. She's a prostitute, and she sits on the beast. Now, this is the same beast that Pastor Rick introduced to us back in chapter 13. We're going to get to the beast here in just a moment. Lady Babylon is mesmerizing. She's captivating. So much so that at the end of verse 6, John says, "I stared at her in complete amazement." And when you look at a couple verses down, I think it's verse 8, the angel says, "Why are you so amazed? Snap out of it. I got some more vision to give to you." So wherever she is breathtaking. Lady Babylon's clothes are very fancy, and they indicate, wealth and high social status. The book of Revelation is written with the Roman Empire as its backdrop. Very important that we know that for today. And Rome, didn't have a king, but the colors of red and purple would have been associated with royalty or people of means. Lady Babylon was no fan of God's people. Verse 6 says she was drunk with the blood of God's holy people. When you look at Revelation 18:6, it says that she brewed a cup of terror for them. Now this image of Babylon would have been a familiar one for the Christians receiving this writing from John back in his time period. Babylon was an enemy empire that came in and took the Jewish people captive back in the Old Testament. And for me, for Revelation, a lot of John's message is written with this Roman Empire kind of in the background. And if you took the world of Christ followers and you took the world of the Roman Empire, they could not be more different in terms of their values and in terms of what was more important to them, what was most important to them, and their goals. And so John can't come right out and say, look, don't fall in love with Rome. John can't come out and say, you know, whatever the emperor says, don't do. He's got to kind of write the code a little bit. And so Babylon would have been code for Rome. And the people receiving this writing would have had a much better understanding of the Old Testament than we do. And they would have understood what Babylon meant to the Old Testament people. And speaking of the Old Testament, the Old Testament gives us a full understanding of this imagery that John is using today. If you're taking notes, you can jot down some of these verses. We'll look up a couple of them quickly, but turn to Isaiah 1, 21. Isaiah 1, 21. It's going to be page 518 on the left-hand side there. My Bible says, unfaithful Jerusalem. Verse 21 says this, see how Jerusalem, once so faithful, has become a prostitute. Once the home of justice and righteousness, she is now filled with murderers. Jump over to Jeremiah 2, verse 20. I'll be go to the right just a little bit, the next book. The bottom of page 571. Well, not the bottom. Right-hand side towards the middle there, page 571. The prophet says this, long ago I broke the yoke that oppressed you and tore away the chains of your slavery, but you said I will not serve you. On every hill and under every green tree you have prostituted yourselves by bowing down to idols. Another one to look up later would be Ezekiel chapter 23 verses 1 through 11. I'm not going to read that this morning. When I read that earlier this week, I honestly blushed a little bit because the imagery is very explicit, shall we say. And that's just kind of a side note for people who think the scripture is boring. Read a passage like Ezekiel 23 and that would get like a PG-13 R type of rating on that material. Right? Just, the Bible is a very colorful book. But John's audience was very familiar with the Old Testament. When they heard texts like this, it reminded them of the covenant that God made with his people. And when you broke that covenant, God called you an adulterer. He called you unfaithful. He compared his covenant with his people as like the relationship between a husband and a wife. And when you break that covenant, you're unfaithful. You're an adulterer. You're a prostitute. But who exactly does Lady Babylon represent, and who or what is she committing adultery with? Let's remember there's a few principal bad guys in the book of Revelation. The first is this red dragon, who we saw in chapter 12. We learned that to be the devil. The beast in chapter 13, we're introduced to the beast in chapter 13. We'll look a little bit more of him later. But this beast comes to represent kind of the political and the governmental realm of life. A political or governmental entity. He's a king, or represents kings. And then chapter 13 of Revelation talks about another beast. Some of us maybe call this the Antichrist or the false prophet. And the role of the Antichrist or the false prophet is to get the people to worship the first beast. And so this false prophet or this Antichrist has a religious aspect of who he is. So Lady Babylon cannot be Satan. And she cannot be government or politics. And she cannot be religion. So what other aspect of life is there? Jump to verse 18 in chapter 17. The angel says this to John, this woman you saw in your vision represents the great city that rules over the kings of the world. Now the great city, again, is maybe a reference to Rome. Look at chapter 18, verse 3. The kings of the world have committed adultery with her. Because of her desires for extravagant luxury, the merchants of the world have grown rich. So the kings of this world have committed adultery with her, and the merchants of this world have gained from whoever Lady Babylon is. Whoever this Lady Babylon person is, the kings are in cahoots with her, and the merchants have got wealthier off of her. One more clue. Chapter 18 talks about Lady Babylon's defeat. Let's look at who is sad that she has been defeated. Verse 9 says the kings of this world are sad. Verses 11 and 15 of chapter 18 say that the merchants of the world, of this world, are sad because there's no one left to buy their stuff. So again, whoever Lady Babylon is, there's people getting rich off of her. And when she goes down, apparently the whole system goes down. So there's no one left to get wealthy off of her. And verse 18 and 19 says that the captains of the merchant ships and their passengers and crew will also, you know, weep or mourn when Lady Babylon is defeated. Why would that be? Because again, their livelihood has dried up. If no one is buying stuff, if the merchants aren't able to sell their stuff and get wealthy, there's no need to ship stuff anymore. So Lady Babylon is essentially aspects of life not represented by religion or the government. She's the economy. She's culture. She's the buying and selling aspects of life. Another term we might use to talk about Lady Babylon would be the world. She's concerned with the things of the world, with stuff, with possessions, with getting ahead in life. She's intoxicated the kings of this world, and the people have benefited greatly from who she is. They've gotten wealthier, they've gotten richer off of her and her system. And chapter 18 talks about when that system collapses, there's going to be a lot of people sad because she has been defeated. And it can be easy to be mesmerized with Lady Babylon. I mean, even John himself, he's in the midst of getting the vision, and he is awestruck at Lady Babylon. You see, here in America, it's not too hard to identify with Lady Babylon. Now, I want to tell you, I'm not saying that America is Lady Babylon in the book of Revelation. Not saying that today. So when Pastor Doug gets back, you can't tell him. I did not say that. All I'm saying is that when you look at the Roman Empire that John is writing against, there's enough similarity between that empire and the American Empire, if you will. And so when we think about life in America, we think about how we are the wealthiest people in the world. Now, I know in our own country we talk about, you know, the 1%, the 90%, 99%, and all that, but the poorest person in America is still some of the richest people in the world, globally. We benefit greatly from the world's economic system. We started some of that. We've kept a lot of that going. And you could say, well, our economy is shakier. It might get shakier. There are things in the future that don't look as promising as they once did, and that would all be true. But I want to ask this, what would happen if there was another economic depression? What if you and I lost our homes? What if you lost your job? What if you lost your retirement, your health care, your savings? How sad would you be? What if it all went away? What if the whole thing collapsed? And we lost everything. Would we grieve for the fall of America like the merchants were grieving for the fall of Babylon? Or would there still be something else in life that we would have hope for? John is warning against this. John was there when Jesus said in the Gospels, "You cannot serve both God and money." John heard it himself. And those two simply will not compete with one another. John's message for followers of Christ back then was, don't get so intoxicated with this Roman Empire. Don't get so caught up in this system. Don't make your life so dependent upon how successful the empire does that you forget about the God who came to save you. And you can participate in the economy. Don't become fixated with it. You can buy and sell, but don't make the buying and selling your God. Because any time we place God to the side and put something else in that spot, we're cheating on Him. And all those verses that talk about how Jerusalem and the Jewish people cheat on God, those would apply to us as well. All right, back to chapter 17, a little bit more information here about the beast. Look at verses 7 and 8. I will tell you the mystery of this woman and of the beast with seven heads and ten horns on which she sits. The beast you saw was once alive, but is not now, and yet he will soon come up out of the bottomless pit and go to eternal destruction. Now, what's happening here is a contrast between this figure of the beast and God. It's not as clear in the New Living, but notice what it says about the beast. The beast what? Was once alive, but is not now, and yet will soon come up out of the bottomless pit. So the beast existed, is not existing now, and in the future will exist at some point. It's just it's a play on that imagery because of God our Father has always existed. We serve a God who was, and who is, and who is to come. And so it's a neat contrast there between our God and between this beast. The beast was, God was, the beast is not, our God is. Our God is very present right now. The beast will come and will be destroyed. Our God will continue to exist for all of eternity. All right, look at verses 9 and 10. A little more info on this beast. This calls for a mind with understanding. The seven heads of the beast represent the seven hills where the woman rules. They also represent seven kings. Five kings have already fallen. The sixth now reigns, and the seventh is yet to come. But his reign will be brief. When I was planning for today, I really wanted to skip these two verses. I just wanted to just kind of hope you didn't see them. Because these are probably two of the most difficult verses to understand in all of the book. Because when you read the different commentators and scholars, no one knows what to do with these. The easy part is the seven hills. Because the seven hills refers to Rome. Rome was known to have sat on seven hills. If you could get a bit more time, I'd show you the names of the various hills that ancient literature has for the Roman Empire. That's a clear reference to Rome. What's more difficult here is these seven kings, because the vision says five kings have already fallen, the sixth now reigns, and the seventh is yet to come. So what do we do with that? Here's a side note. If you ever get into a discussion with someone about the book of Revelation, and they seem so confident of their interpretation, there's no doubt, there's no mystery in their understanding of Revelation. You take them to these two verses, and you ask them, okay, well, what do you think about that? I guarantee you they would be wrong. Because no one really knows, all right? I'll give you a couple popular theories. The first popular theory is that these seven kings represent seven Roman emperors. Actual, historical Roman emperors. John wrote this, or received this vision, AD 90, somewhere along those lines, where Emperor Domitian was the emperor during that time. The problem with using this particular way to understand that is that there are more than five emperors before Domitian's reign, and there are certainly more than two emperors that come after Domitian's reign. So really kind of throw that out. Now, some people within that theory like to kind of combine some of those emperors into one and try to make it work, but then you're just fudging. You're just, making it say what you want it to say. The other popular theory is that John isn't talking about emperors per se, but he's talking about kingdoms. And that before this time period, there had been five powerful kingdoms. Now, we're going to get into a little bit of classic civilization stuff. I might bore you just a little bit, if not already. But the kingdoms reference to these, to the Babylonians, and then to the Greek empires, which would include the Medo-Persians, the Ptolemies, and the United Macedonians, which is Alexander's rule, and then the Romans. So people will say, look, Rome is the fifth kingdom. Well, again, we can make the argument that there are other kingdoms that came before Rome that aren't included in this list. Egypt comes to mind. Certainly the Chinese come to mind. They had some good world domination going on before the birth of Christ. And then after the fall of the Roman Empire, which isn't for a couple hundred years after John gets this vision, you can make the argument there were more than two kingdoms that came after Rome's fall as well. So then what is John talking about? Well, we're going to fall back to the idea that sometimes, or most of the time, numbers in Revelation are symbolic. And here, when we're talking about seven kings, and, you know, the sixth now reigning, and the seventh is yet to come, seven is a number of completeness and wholeness. And so if we're in the sixth kingdom, we're close to the end, or it's incomplete. When the seventh kingdom comes, the seventh king comes, the time is done. John is not concerned with being a historian at this point. His point, as is the point with other biblical writers who write about the end of time, is to say that we're the next to last one of these kings, whatever that looks like, and regardless of how long it takes. I think something we forget when we come to the book of Revelation is this. I think we forget or we miss that a lot of generations before us thought that they were in the last generation. I remember growing up as a kid, and my mom, she firmly believed that Christ was coming back during her time period. And the older she's gotten, the less confident she is of that belief. And sometimes, not her per se, but people who have that perspective will say, well, then it's going to come during, you know, the kids' generation. Or it's going to come during the grandkids' generation. And it just keeps getting ratcheted down. But really, since Christ left the earth, most generations believe they were in the end of time. We don't have time this morning to read 1st and 2nd Thessalonians, but if you have time this week, you ought to do that. Read 1st Thessalonians, where Paul seems pretty confident that Christ is coming back. He's pretty much talks about this idea of a rapture, which is where we get that idea from, not the book of Revelation, and kind of making people get ready for the end of time. Then 2nd Thessalonians is written. And what Paul is basically saying in 2nd Thessalonians is this: I guess I was wrong. Get back to work, you lazy piles. Alright, because what the people had done is they had just sold their workplaces, sold their homes, and were like waiting. Like seriously, just staring, waiting, day after day. And Paul writes a second letter to say, look, there's too much work to do for you to just sit and wait. And when you look at history, generation after generation believed they were in the end of time. And so John is to say, look, we're in the sixth. We're in the realm that sixth time now. The seventh one is the last one. It's the complete one. That may happen soon. That may happen a long time from now. But from the whole of time, we can guarantee that it's sooner than later. But honestly, your time and my time on earth can end at any moment. And I think of some of the tragedies that we've seen in our communities the last couple of weeks, and then we think about what's happened in our country the last couple of months. I know it can be cliche, but none of us know how much time we have left on this earth. You're not guaranteed 80 years. You're not guaranteed tomorrow. I'm not guaranteed this afternoon. So we are to be ready. And we are to not be so concerned about the things that Lady Babylon represents. Not to be so concerned with the things of this world that we miss out on the things that are going to count after our life is done, after life period is done. All right, one last theme to point out this morning. Look at chapter 17, verse 16. The vision says this: the scarlet beast and his 10 horns all hate the prostitute. They will strip her naked, eat her flesh, and burn her remains with fire. This is interesting because here you have two of the dominant figures of evil in the book of Revelation, the beast and Lady Babylon, going at each other. They hate each other. And so it's like the government and political realm represented by the beast cannot tolerate the people, the culture, the economy represented by Lady Babylon, and they are seeking to destroy her. These two figures of sin and evil cannot stand one another. Now, keep a pinky in Revelation. Turn over to Matthew, chapter 12. We're going to be on page 743, and look at verses 24. It's on the middle of the left-hand side there on page 743. Interesting backdrop for this idea of the beast and the prostitute going at each other. Look at what Jesus says. Jesus has just cast out a demon from someone, and there's some discussion or controversy over whether Jesus has the authority to cast out demons. So the Pharisees heard about the miracle. They said, no wonder he can cast out demons. He gets his power from Satan, the prince of demons. Jesus knew their thoughts and replied this: any kingdom divided by civil war is doomed. A town or family splintered by feuding will fall apart. And if Satan is casting out Satan, he is divided and fighting against himself. His own kingdom will not survive. A house divided will not stand. A kingdom divided against itself will not survive. It's interesting that, as Pastor Doug talked about a couple of weeks with this, you know, the Battle of Armageddon, kind of popular imagery that goes with that, that God's going to come back in a vengeance and just annihilate everyone that isn't with him. That there's certainly evidence for that kind of thought. Certainly God in the Old Testament punished people and judged people in such a way. But here, you almost have God standing in the background a little bit, letting evil just cancel itself out. The beast and Lady Babylon going at it. A house divided. Satan being divided. Not being able to stand. Not being able to keep it going. There's plenty of evidence where God doesn't need to punish, but rather let us experience the consequences of our poor decisions. I mean, if you've parented, or if you've coached, or if you've taught, or if you've done anything in a leadership type of position, you understand the difference between punishing and just letting someone experience the consequences of their poor decisions. When I try to live life against the way God wants me to live life, and when I experience bad things, I'm tempted to say, God, why are you punishing me? But really what's happening is I'm just experiencing the consequences of my poor decisions. If we try to live life our own way, if we keep sinning and going against the way God would want us to live, there's consequences to those choices. In Revelation 17, it's interesting to consider maybe a different image of the battle between good and evil. An image where a good God doesn't need to directly act, but rather simply stands back and let a divided kingdom go at it and destroy itself. And so I think we've come somewhat full circle. Because the danger for you and I as Christians in America is that we keep trying to serve two masters. That we keep trying to do the God church thing and also keep trying to do the whatever other thing that is. The money thing, the status thing, the ego thing, the work thing, the family thing. And if we try to do both, or if we cheat on God and place God to the side and say, I'm going to go all in on Lady Babylon, I'm going to put my chips on that, we're going to lose our soul. And you're going to find yourself, I'll find myself in a house divided, where God doesn't need to punish me. He'll just simply let me experience the consequence of that very poor decision. The New Testament is a continual call to you and I of who we are going to serve, of who or what is going to have the most important place in our life. And what Revelation 17, 18 say is that if you place your faith in the empire, if you place your faith in the system, it will go very poorly for you in the end. And so what John is trying to say to the Christians back then is, hold on. Endure your persecution. Stay true to Christ. And I think that's the message for us today as well. Hold true to Christ. Let's pray. Father, I want to thank you for this morning, and thank you so much for this church. And Father, I think of the week here at Hillcrest with some of the remodeling that happened. And I thank you for the support of the people here who made that possible, and both through treasure given and through time given. Thank you so much for how you blessed us this week. Father, I thank you so much for your word and for the truth that it contains. And Father, I pray that not only did we learn some stuff this morning, but that we found ways that we could make a difference in our day-to-day lives. May we not chase after things that in the end won't matter. May we continue to pursue you. Continue to pursue the people you want us to pursue. Father, may people see our lives and be drawn closer to you as a result. Father, as we get ready to give you this offering, we thank you so much for the privilege that we have to give to you today. We pray that you would use these monies to bring folks here and throughout your world closer to who you are. It's a privilege to give to you today. We pray these things in your name. As the ushers come to the front, as the plates are passed, if you have a connection card you want to fill out and put that in, we invite you to do that as well. Well, I want to thank you for coming out this morning. I hope to see some of you, many of you, over at the Pizza Ranch here in a little bit, 41st Street. Thanks for coming. Have a great day. Thursday.